This week's episode of Undisclosed is brought to you by Stamps.com. Most of us are trying to find more time every day to get things done. So you can't let trips to the post office slow you down. Now you don't have to, thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can buy and print official U.S. postage right from your own computer and printer. You'll never waste valuable time going to the post office again. Sign up for Stamps.com and use my promo code UNDISCLOSED for this special offer. You get a 4-week trial, plus $110 in bonus offer, including postage and a digital scale. Go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage, and type in UNDISCLOSED. Stamps.com and enter UNDISCLOSED.
Hi, and welcome to Undisclosed. Today's episode is Subscriber Activity, part 4 of our post-conviction relief hearing coverage. This is Colin Miller, an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law. I also blog at Evidence Prof Blog. I'm joined as always by my colleagues Rabia Chowdhury and Susan Simpson. Rabia is an attorney and senior fellow at the U.S. Institute of Peace, and she blogs at splitthemoon.com. And Susan is an associate at the Volkoff Law Group in Washington, D.C., and she blogs at The View from LL2. Now, last episode, we focused upon the cross-examination of Asia McLean and the possible effect it'll have on Adnan's claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. This week, we shift gears to the cell tower evidence. Was the state misleading in its disclosures? Was Christina Gutierrez ineffective in challenging it? And what exactly is the meaning of the AT&T disclaimer stating that incoming calls are unreliable for determining location? Let's turn to the testimony.
Going into the PCR hearing, the defense actually had two expert witnesses for the cell phone evidence. One they were going to use on direct and one they'd have for rebuttal to refute the state's arguments concerning the cell phone stuff. The first one was Jerry Grant. He is affiliated with the Innocence Network and Barry Scheck. And in preparation for the hearing, he talked to Abe Wernowitz, the original cell phone expert at Adnan's trial, and he'd reviewed all of the records involving the cell phone issues. He talked about how at trial, Wernowitz had affirmed the reliability of the AT&T call records, and how before trial, Wernowitz had done limited drive testing consisting of making outbound calls at various locations and recording results for the single strongest tower at that moment that the test call was made. He also talked in general about how cell phone analysis works and how he operates when he's looking into a case. And Justin asked him at one point, "Are you familiar with how phone companies give instructions for how to read records?" And Jerry Grant responded, "Yes, he gets them for each case, and he saves copies for his past cases as well, because the instructions can change over time and systems and data formats change. So by having past copies of instructions, it helps him with analysis and showing any sort of differences or new developments in the way that the companies are storing records." He gave an example of how a company may shift from keeping all the records in Central Time to Eastern Time. And so for that reason, you couldn't use an instruction sheet from several years ago to interpret records from now because the way the data was saved and produced might have changed. And he said that companies usually provide automatically a copy of these instructions on how to interpret cell phone records. And if they don't, you just go back and ask for it. Jerry Grant also explained the Frank exhibit, Exhibit 31. And Justin had him talk through what that exhibit consisted of and how it was made. Essentially, Exhibit 31, as we've talked about before, has an affidavit, which is from an AT&T security analysis, which says the following records are business records of AT&T. It then has a single page with the subscriber info for Adnan's phone, stating that Bilal was the owner of the main account, that the phone itself, its number, the date it was started, all that kind of general subscriber info. That page comes from a fax that was made from AT&T to the Baltimore Police Department on February 17th. I'll probably be calling it the 217 fax for shorthand. And the last three pages of Exhibit 31 come from a different fax on February 22nd, or the 222 fax. And those three pages show the calls, the times of the calls, the duration of the call, the outgoing number, and the cell site that is initially used in connecting the phone to the tower once a call is either initiated or an incoming call is made. Grant also explained that the 222 fax is a subscriber activity report because it says on top, subscriber activity report. Justin asked him, "Do you have any doubt that the instruction on how to read subscriber activity reports applies to Exhibit 31? And Jerry Grant said, "No doubt in my mind, it does."
He asked the question generally, but does he ask very specifically, like, how would you interpret this instruction?
He does. And he says, well, here's what the instruction says here. It says that on the top, how to read subscriber activity reports. So for documents that say they're subscriber activity reports, you would use the instructions like AT&T intended. And he said that, you know, the instructions are there for a reason. They're instructions on how to read these records. They don't just randomly make up words and random phrases to, you know, confuse law enforcement.
So Justin didn't ask him specifically about the instruction that, like, is at the heart of the matter here, which is, you know, that incoming cell phone calls are not reliable for location. I mean, like, did he ask specifically about that instruction?
Yeah, and he said it applied to the cell phone records here, okay. 31, because it's a subscriber activity report. Grant also testified about his prior conversation with Abe Wernowitz, and he said that during that call, Abe told him that he saw the cell phone records just prior to his testimony at Anand's trial. He hadn't seen the records before that, and that he never saw the cover sheet. Abe also explained that he was an engineer. He worked with engineering issues, and that he did not have any experience billing documents, and that the documents here, the subscriber activity reports, were billing records, not engineering documents. So the direct was pretty straightforward. There were a few points Justin was trying to make that were important, but basically foundational, in discussing just what the records are, what the records in this case were, and why, when reading cell phone records, you should use an instruction sheet given by the phone company that made the records. On cross, Thiru went everywhere. I have in my notes here, Thiru tries to emphasize that the AT&T instruction sheet is somehow a magical, unreliable unicorn. As in, this sheet, it doesn't actually mean anything. It's just there as like the biggest of red herrings, and it's a bizarre idea to think that an instruction sheet applies to records it came with, and that anyone who thinks that is crazy. And he does try, like, over and over again to make the point that no one has ever before in the history of the world argued that an instruction sheet applies to cell phone records, or that this incoming call issue the instruction sheet talks about actually exists. And at one point he asked G.I. Grant, have you ever seen this instruction before? And Grant said, no, I haven't seen this particular one, but each company does things differently and they change over time. But companies keep records in different ways, so they're not going to have the same instruction sheet.
That's interesting because I blogged about a case. There's a Court of Appeals of Maryland case, State versus Payne, which actually involved very similar facts that an expert testified about cell tower records, and he had an instruction sheet that was not turned over to the defense. And in fact, that sheet was very pertinent and relevant in terms of interpreting the instructions. And it's part of the reason why the case was reversed, was because those instructions weren't turned over to the defense.
The judge isn't going to find that one unless he reads your blog.
Yeah, I mean, but it's, I mean, I would imagine the first thing that he or his clerk would do is to look at cases where this was an issue. And there's that Payne case, which is the Court of Appeals. There's Wilder versus State, which is the Court of Special Appeals. And they're both about the importance of having an expert come in and testify to the reliability of cell tower records. And you're talking about Grant now, obviously. We'll get to Abe Wernowitz down the road, but he's basically repudiating his testimony and saying, I wouldn't have testified as I did based upon the instructions. So there's a very small number of cases in Maryland that deal with cell tower records. Those are two of them. So I would imagine, hopefully, that he would consider those.
Well, at one point, Thiru outright asked G.I. Grant, have you ever heard about the complaint before regarding incoming calls? And the way he set the question up, it's clear Thiru expected a negative answer. And Grant says, well, yeah, I have. And Thiru tries to move on to avoid that section. And later he asks, is it possible that the reason that no other attorney has ever made this argument about the AT&T instruction sheet is because you're misinterpreting the instructions? And Grant said, no, that's not what I said. I said I haven't been involved in a case where an attorney has made that argument. But I've seen records and transcripts from cases where they have. But it's like Thiru wasn't listening, because he continued to beat this drum over and over again about how no attorney ever has ever made this argument. And it's a crazy, insane claim that no one would ever actually present in a court of law unless they're doing it at a PCR hearing to try and trick a judge. And he keeps saying that, you know, this is a perfect example of Kulbecki, because this is an insane argument that Gutierrez would have had no reason to make.
Yeah, just following up, Susan, on your point that Thiru was trying to make, I'm reading here from the Payne case, which was the case I'd referenced before. And this says, Detective Edwards testified that he could determine the call time, phone number called, whether the call was incoming or outgoing, and the cell tower through which the cell phone communicated based on the complete records he had received from Sprint Nextel. When Payne's counsel objected to the detective's testimony on the ground that Detective Edwards needed to be qualified as an expert in order to interpret the data, the state responded that the actual records contained step-by-step instructions as to the use of the records, although neither the actual records nor the instructions were introduced into evidence. And on appeal, the defendant's claim in his brief was that, quote, the instructions were not provided in discovery. And again, that's a big reason why his conviction was reversed. So Thiru apparently made this argument, but a very quick Westlaw search by Judge Welch or his clerk would show that, in fact, this instruction argument was raised and, in fact, was sustained before. And this was just a couple of years ago, 2014. This is Maryland's highest court in 2014, a case involving instructions and the failure to turn them over. So this is not a novel or unique argument in Maryland. It's something that very recently was used to turn over a conviction.
And just common sense tells you it's not a novel or bizarre argument. I mean, at times it really, hearing Thiru up there arguing and being all scornful of the idea that an instruction sheet could apply to records it comes with, I can't imagine that I was too impressed, because it's just, he's basically saying that Gutierrez would have to be insane to think instructions applied to the records. But the records say how to read subscriber activity reports, and the records themselves have subscriber activity report at the top. So trying to prove that is preposterous, seemed like a bridge too far.
I mean, it's really frustrating to me. I feel like this kind of thing happened again and again at the PCR where, and I don't know if it's just an act of desperation. It could be, because there's not a lot of ways you can go. I mean, we buy something, it comes with an instruction booklet. There's a reason it's there. That's just how like kind of everything works. So I don't know if it's an act of desperation, but to me, either way, it is so incredibly disingenuous that I have trouble believing that he actually believes what he's saying. You know, I can't imagine somebody as bright as Thiru is that he actually believes what he's saying, which then seems so disingenuous and just about trying to win. Although I, again, agree with you, Susan, I can't imagine if the judge is paying even the slightest bit of attention that any of this makes any sense to him.
I actually think he believes it. I think part of why it came off so ineffectively is because he does believe it.
In what universe can anybody think that instructions that come with anything don't actually apply to that thing?
Like, what? Yeah, but the way he presented it, he seemed like a true believer. He seemed so confident that he had the answer. And, you know, maybe he's a good actor, but I think he actually thought this was the truth. And the way he like belabored over it, like he was trying to explain to a kindergartner how things worked, it did seem like he thought he had the answer, the right answer, the truthful answer. You know, who knows? But I kind of think if he'd been doing this intentionally, it would have been a more subtle, and
he would have been better at it.
But we know too, I mean, maybe I'm going forward too much, but Susan, from what I recall from social media, and when we get to Fitzgerald, doesn't Fitzgerald himself eventually admit that the instructions do apply because of the voicemail call after track practice?
It's really hard to say what he actually admitted to or didn't, because he talks and didn't really say anything.
I thought there was something, though, about how even he acknowledged that Warnowitz would have changed one part of his testimony, which is that maybe the 5:14 p.m. call where he said that was a call that was answered when the instructions showed that was a call going to voicemail.
Oh, yeah. He said that if Abe had the instruction sheet, he would have gotten that right. He just said that the rest of it wouldn't have changed because Fitzgerald's interpretation was correct.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Judge Welch has to say. Again, I think the best conclusion that he could draw is look right at the Payne case, and that's Maryland's highest court ruling directly on the issue.
Well, on redirect for Grant, Justin just mostly was focused on the point that even buying what Thiru just said on cross, that the only thing the instruction sheet applies to is this column called location one, which lists the name of the switch that a cell site's on. If that's wrong, then all the records are even more wrong under Justin's theory, because you can't have the location one column be wrong without the whole cell site being wrong. So even though Thiru's theory didn't actually have a factual basis, it doesn't help him. I should probably go back and explain this. So on the cell phone records, you have a, like I said, the time of the call, duration, the number it's made to, and there's two columns on the farthest right. One of them is the cell site, and it has a number designating a certain cell site, which you can cross-reference to a list of towers and their addresses. And then it has a column, which at the very top of it is labeled location one, no space. This column has the name of the switch that the cell site that the call was on is located in. And switches cover like large geographical areas. For instance, the main switch that Anon usually connects to is called the Washington switch under the records. He's in Baltimore, but the switch has Baltimore and Washington towers under it. So theorists saying that it only applies to the name of the switch. That's what's incorrect on incoming calls. But if that's the case, then, I mean, then the records are completely useless. You can't even tell like what state someone's in. And then on recross, we have Theorist going back again, and he says to Grant, I suggested that location refers to location one column, right? Answer, yes. Question, you're saying that's a faulty assumption? Answer, yes. When a specific thing applies to a specific field, it will name that field correctly, which is a common sense point. If you're going to designate a specific field on a list of cells, you're going to name the column that is actually labeled. Typically, when you say location, you're talking about the word location. And if you want to instead refer to a technical field labeled location number one, you would match that labeling, typically. I mean, it's not unreasonable to think that. If Theor is correct about this, he should have something more than his belief in what's more common sense to back it up.
Yeah, and plus the disclaimer, it does say incoming calls are unreliable for location, but that is following a sentence that says that outgoing calls are reliable for location status. So you sort of, if you're using the rules of construction English there, it would make sense you're talking about status as opposed to the location one column.
Yeah. Got interesting because I mentioned earlier there were two cell phone experts that the defense had. And for Jerry Grant, Justin had a very specific goal in mind for what he wanted to get out, what he wanted to get across, what he wanted to prove. And that did not involve getting into the nitty-gritty. He just wanted to lay out the basic facts and give the common sense reasons why instructions apply to records that come with. But Theo wanted to go beyond that. So he starts to ask Jerry Grant, any idea why AT&T would distinguish between incoming and outgoing calls for reliability? And Grant started to answer, saying, yes, in earlier years for AT&T, that incoming call data would reflect different. And then at that point, actually, there was an objection. And Justin said, objection, beyond the scope of redirect, and beyond the scope of direct, for that matter, because this is not stuff that Justin ever got into. And he didn't strategically. He wanted to put that off until the second cell phone expert, as you'll see why in a second. And that objection was overruled. So Theor goes on, what is your best explanation for why the cover sheet says incoming calls are not reliable? And Grant says, well, you know, it's more than one reason, but a big problem here is that the way AT&T records data doesn't reflect the reality of which phone connected to the tower, and starts talking about the incoming call issue where AT&T switches the callers and the callees' cell sites. But luckily for the defense, Theor cut him off. I mean, you have the witness there about to, like, telegraph everything the defense is going to be claiming later. But rather than use the chance to prep his own expert witness or to get some intel on what's coming next, Theor cuts him off and says, do you want to know what the actual answer is? And I don't think Grant answered that question. But Theor followed up with, will you be here tomorrow? And Grant started to answer, like, well, I hadn't planned my schedule, but I can be here if needed to give more testimony or rah, thinking that's what Theor was asking about. And then Theor dramatically, like, it's like a freaking Matlock moment. He says, be here tomorrow for our witness, and then you'll find out what the actual answer is.
That is amazing. And I can't believe I missed it all.
Yeah. And that's why I said that I think Theor is a true believer here. I mean, that little scene, plus there's all the pin throwing going on during his Grant's testimony. To me, he seemed like a man who thought he knew the answer and was super frustrated that he had to deal with, I mean, he was frustrated he had to deal with the question at all, but I think he actually thought he knew what the answer was.
This is interesting. So he asks him the question, but then he cuts him off before he can answer. Like, why? I'm trying to figure out what was the strategy behind that. Do you think he never wanted him to actually answer it? Or do you think, I mean, it was a save for the defense, as we'll find out later, because Justin didn't want to go there. But why would he, I mean, is that even proper, like, in court to ask a witness a question and then say, yeah, never mind?
Yeah, here's what I thought was going on. I thought that Theroux was thinking that Grant would say, I don't know. He'd use that to springboard into his little speech where he said, well, if you don't know, you want to know the real answer? I do. I'll tell it to you tomorrow. So the fact that Grant started to give an answer kind of threw a gear in his little script.
It's completely improper. In fact, if you look through the transcript from Adnan's trial, Gutierrez often starts cutting off witnesses, and the judge basically says, please allow the witness to complete their answer. You're not allowed to cut off a witness you've asked a question who's giving a valid answer.
Thero cut off Asia all the time. It got old fast because if she'd start to answer, he'd cut her off midway, and Justin would object and say, she's still talking, and Thero would be, he would say this several times, I think she was finished, but, you know, she can keep going if she wants or something, you know. Sometimes Asia just wouldn't continue because she just gotten cut off and didn't want to get back into whatever just happened, so it was a reoccurring issue. Get to everybody's favorite cast member, Chad Fitzgerald. He was the state's cell phone expert, and he was with the FBI's group that is responsible for cell phone interpretation. They're kind of an elite group, quote unquote. In the first part, during the direct of Chad Fitzgerald's testimony, I was super bored. I started doodling in my notes, like, it was so boring. And you know, if I am there, like, bored, I don't know if anyone else was paying attention. It was dull. It was not interesting. It was very slow. It got more exciting on cross, though.
Fitzgerald is part of this cast team on the FBI. It's the Cellular Analysis Survey Team. And what they do is basically what Warnowitz kind of did in this case. They do drive tests and they test the signal strength of different towers. And their claim, as we referenced in the ping episode, is not only that a ping can show the location of the phone within a 2-mile radius, but in fact, I've seen some of the PowerPoints because there's a trial here in Greenville where this was done. It's these very narrow crescents that they create and try to say, we can pinpoint the location of the phone in this very narrow crescent. And it's very controversial because, as we noted in that episode, many people say that the radius is much larger, 5 miles or so. But that is essentially the function of this FBI cast team. It's to go to cases around the country. There was one recently in Knoxville in Tennessee where it was used for the first time. And they are tools of the prosecution to try to pinpoint location, whereas many people question exactly how much you can pinpoint that location.
And the CAS team is responsible for pushing probably the most aggressive interpretation of this data from any source or professionals that I'm aware of. They have a very strict approach to, and by strict I mean they tend to treat cell site data as if it were somehow this very precise, completely predictable, and limited type of communication system. What drives me crazy is that there's no science behind this. There's no attempt to try and, you know, use the scientific method to try and replicate studies, to try and evaluate accuracy. It's not a science. Part of me thinks, well, it could just be because it's the government and who knows why. But if it actually did what they said it could do, why not have some peer-reviewed studies showing it? Chad Fitzgerald started off basically trying to throw some shade at Grant and claiming he wasn't a real expert. He just watched YouTube videos. And he had a very casual attitude to it all. From the very beginning, to the way he admitted he had basically had very little, like he didn't know much of the case, but he was confident he knew all the answers. And I kind of had like sympathetic nervousness watching this because I'm like, why would you put yourself in this position? I still don't know, but he did. So at the very start of his testimony, Thero asks him, have you spoken with me about this case? And he says, yeah, we had about maybe 2-hour altogether phone conversations. And then I spent 20 minutes with you today or yesterday. And Thero asked him, what have you reviewed? And he said, I was given all the documents, all the cell records and the files. which may be true, but he didn't review them all, as we'll get into later.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, Theroux asks him that, did you notice the fax cover sheet? That's part of this exhibit. And his answer, Fitzgerald's answer, is that I didn't pay too much attention to the faxes are sent to or from the dates, and that Baltimore police use the same fax cover for all its faxes, like AT&T use the same fax cover, and that he has a stack of identical cover sheets I use for my own faxes. So his immediate response basically is like, yeah, all the faxes have fax covers and I don't really pay attention to them, which maybe is the whole problem here.
He was not a curious person. It's the kindest way I could put it.
Yeah, that's a kind way to put it.
Theroux goes through several documents and says, are you familiar with the cover sheet? Are you familiar with the 222 records, with the 217 records? And Theroux asks, what are the 222 records? And Fitzgerald says, they're CDRs, our call detail records. And Theroux asks, what are the 217 records? And Fitzgerald says, they're toll records. Now, a CDR is kind of a generalized term, but it applies to, like, generally the most or the more detailed type of records you'll get from the phone companies. They have things like cell site data. They have the call listings, durations. They'll have more than the stuff you'll get on your cell phone bill. The toll records, in contrast, in general, refers to things like when a call was made, how long it lasted, and then sometimes to who the call was either from or made to, if that kind of data is available. But they're much less detailed than are the CDRs, typically.
So the toll records kind of sound like your bill.
That's what a toll record is. It's tolling the, yeah, that's a good way of putting it. The tolls are there to keep track of what you owe. Then Theroux tried to ask Fitzgerald what he'd done in reviewing the rest of the evidence. He asked him if he'd read the testimony of Abe Warnowitz, and Fitzgerald said yes. I'm skeptical of this claim, as you'll see why later. He asked him if he'd done his own evaluation of the cell evidence, and Fitzgerald said, yes, I took notes on testimony and plotted out the cell sites as best I could. And he says that Warnowitz's analysis was full and thorough as it could have been short of one step. I thought his work was pretty good for 1999. So when Theroux asked him, did he come to the same conclusion as Warnowitz had, Fitzgerald said, I was able to not only follow along with the transcripts, that is, follow the cell site results as compared to the testimony that was being given by Warnowitz. And Fitzgerald continued, but also earlier this week, I got the list of tower locations and I went back and verified Warnowitz's analysis. A few of the call locations I could verify just by addresses, and the rest I could verify after getting this tower list. Although there was one address I wanted to verify but couldn't for a witness, and then he said I couldn't remember her name, but it started with a P, which is clearly Jen Pusateri. Now, this was shocking to me because two big problems. The first is that earlier this week, so the same week of the hearing, the state cell phone expert sees for the first time the list of tower locations, which means all of his analysis, everything he'd done, had been based on, I don't know what. If you don't know where the towers are, how can you even pretend to do the slightest bit of analysis? It doesn't make sense to me. What he was saying did not register, because if he got all the cell records, how come only this week did he get the records that actually tell you where the towers are? I don't know. But then he's saying he couldn't verify the addresses of certain witnesses like Jen Pusateri. But her address is actually in the transcripts, and it's also on the page of Warnowitz's drive test results. So I don't know what he was actually doing, but he wasn't doing any kind of analysis worthy of the name. I don't know. I knew we were in for a interesting ride, because what he was saying on the stand was essentially that he had done a quick skim of the records and waited until a couple days before the hearing to actually find out the relevant locations in the case. And you cannot do any kind of cell phone analysis like this without knowing locations. That's the very basic issue here. So what he's essentially saying is that I did verify Warnowitz's results and the prosecution's arguments without knowing locations of any towers. Go figure. Theroux turned to the 222, 217 records, and the AT&T instruction sheet. And Theroux asked him, what does the AT&T cover sheet refer to? Have you formed an opinion as to what it refers to? Does it refer to information that is on the CDR? And Fitzgerald said no. Theroux asked, does it apply to the exhibit on the left, referring to the 217 facts? And Fitzgerald said yes. And Theroux asked, what leads you to this conclusion? And His answer was the references to type codes and other things. And at this point, we have all of the state's lovely blow up exhibits brought out. And when I said I was bored earlier, you can see it because here's like my actual notes where Fitz highlights, still highlighting, more highlighting, squeaking highlighter. This is like 10 minutes of Fitzgerald standing in front of a big blow up poster board, like a, you know, a grade school science fair. And Theroux instructs him on how to highlight things. So he's like, Fitzgerald, get the blue highlighter. Highlight this line. Now go highlight these things here on the other sheets. And his point was that the instructions on the AT&T instruction sheet refer to things that some of which only show up on the 217 records and not the 222 records.
That's important because of the way that he describes these two records as being different things.
It's just so nonsensical because this whole issue of how the 217 records are toll records because they don't have cell sites. They don't have cell sites because someone took a Sharpie and scribbled out the cell sites. So basically Fitzgerald's saying you transform CDRs into toll records with a Sharpie. And that somehow affects which document the instruction sheet applies to. I don't think it works that way.
Yeah, well, here's something interesting. I was looking back at that Payne case I mentioned before, that Court of Appeals in Maryland case. And as I quoted before, this is quoting from the opinion, the state responded that the actual records contained step-by-step instructions as to the use of the records, although neither the actual records nor the instructions were introduced into evidence. Now, the records that were introduced into evidence were the call detail records, and this is a footnote in the opinion that says, Edwards later clarified toward the end of his testimony that the instructions were not part of the phone records, but were something he produced from another record. So the state's attorney asks, this is included as part of the cell records. The answer by Edwards, that is not. This is something I produced from another record. So I wouldn't be surprised if the other record in that case was toll records. But in that Payne case, again, that was call detail records admitted into evidence. The authenticating witness used instructions. Those instructions were from another document. And it seems very analogous to the context here.
And the only proof that Theroux offered for why the instruction sheet only applies to the 217, not the 222 records, was basically this little highlighting exercise. And he gets Fitzgerald to say, the key on the answer sheet, I think he was referring to the cover sheet, refers to the report on the left and not the report on the right. As you can see, everything talked about in the key is on the exhibit on the left, aka 217, and not on the exhibit on the right, aka 222. But this isn't even true because the cover sheet instruction manual also says things like all times kept in Eastern Standard. So that part clearly refers to all the records. I mean, I don't know how Fitzgerald can magically go back to 99 and read AT&T's mind to know what parts of that refer to a page that has a Sharpie on it and a page that doesn't have a Sharpie on it. But Theroux asked him, okay, then why does the last page of the 222 record say subscriber activity? Does that change your opinion? And Fitzgerald said, no, it seems to me it's fairly logical. You can't match up all the cover sheet instructions with the 222 records, and you can match them up with the 217 records. And Theroux asked him, have you talked to anyone at AT&T to confirm this? And Fitzgerald says, I've talked to people at AT&T. I briefly discussed it with them last week. And Fitzgerald kind of, as he goes on, he has to correct Theroux at some points. Like, I didn't say we went through the entire key. We just talked about why we logically thought it was there. And Theroux asked him, you know, do they agree with you? And he says, well, nothing they said was inconsistent with my opinion. And when asked about why the instruction manual says location info is not reliable, why the qualifying language is there, Fitzgerald gives his answer. He says that because whenever a phone is, you know, a new phone is given to a customer, an account started, it's assigned to a certain switch. For instance, here's his example. Fitzgerald's phone, because he's from Atlanta, has the Atlanta switch as his home network, and it's routed down to Atlanta. And if he flew up to Baltimore and had his phone off and someone called his phone, even though he was in Baltimore, the phone would still record the switch as Atlanta because that's the default switch. Which means the location one column we talked about, that could be wrong because it could say Atlanta as the cell site switch, referring to like the voicemail cell sites, not a real cell site, just the voicemail. That could be wrong because the phone could have, you know, flown somewhere or be in the air and not have any connection, and therefore the location one column is incorrect.
So this was like the big reveal that Theroux was talking about the day before, that this is why we're going to show you that the incoming cell phone, why that disclaimer is on the fax cover sheet is for this, for the switch reason.
This is it. Are you overwhelmed, Rabia?
I'm just trying to figure out where this is going.
I mean, this is, from what I can understand you saying, Susan, this is the type of testimony that would be insufficient to get the evidence in a trial or to withstand appeal. Because if I'm reading this correctly, it's just Fitzgerald saying, here's what I assumed to be the case. And the AT&T person thought that that could make sense. But neither of them actually has any factual foundation to back that up. It's just, they're just making assumptions, right?
His actual words, and I'm paraphrasing, but I'm not exaggerating here, was that he called up his buddy from AT&T. They talked about why they logically thought the instruction sheet was there. And they logically concluded this is what it means. And that's it. That's the entire extent of his testimony. Is that called up buddy Steve at AT&T. We said, this is probably what it is. And all it's referring to is a switch location and not at all to the cell site. And it would never refer to a cell site. Good to go. Full stop.
I have to just stop and ask something here, because this guy is with the FBI. He is also not a cell technology engineer expert, whatever they're called. How is he able to testify? Because this is just his conclusion. How can he testify to this, like, without being, is he certified as an expert? Like, how is this, like, an FBI agent able to do this without, I don't know, maybe the rules are different for a PCR hearing versus, like, a trial. But wouldn't this be the kind of thing where, like, he would be challenged? Like, you're not an expert on this stuff.
That was kind of my mental monologue during it, because I didn't know what the state was going to come up claiming for the PCR hearing. As it unfolded, I kind of couldn't believe it, because saying you called up your buddy Steve and you kind of logically talked it out, that's not evidence. And his whole cell site thing, here's what his official answer is. On the sheets, you have the list of numbers, times called, etc. You have the cell site column and the location one column. The cell site column lists a number which refers to a specific cell site. And then the location one column refers to the switch name. The instruction sheet from AT&T can only ever refer to the location one slash switch column. It can never, ever refer to the cell site column. And in no way is the cell site data ever affected in any way by the AT&T instruction sheet. It is just the location one slash switch column, which might be affected by an incoming call. That's it. That is essentially his testimony. It did go on, and basically, the more Fitzgerald talked, the more it became clear he had no idea what he was talking about. He, for instance, describes how Woronowitz did testing back in the day, and that his level of analysis was good, and it, you know, it was almost great. But Woronowitz just hadn't done drive testing. That's the one thing he needed to do to have more accurate results. And Theroux asked him, did Abe Woronowitz do drive testing? And Fitzgerald answered, not that I could tell. Well, someone didn't read the transcripts, because if they had, they could tell.
Do you think Theroux also didn't realize this?
So on the previous day when they had Grant testifying, he made a comment that did sound like he thought Abe hadn't done drive testing. And it kind of stood out to me, and I was like, does Theroux not understand? Maybe he just misspoke, or he doesn't understand what he's talking about, because obviously he did drive testing. So I kind of brushed it off as just like him, you know, misspeaking or something. Nope, it sounds like Fitzgerald told him there was no drive testing, so Theroux accepted it. But it's black and white. He did drive testing. I mean, we have the maps of his drive testing, the maps that record the calls and the frequency it heard in the associated cell site. Whatever this guy did to prepare for this hearing, well, maybe he didn't, because he...
My theory is that maybe Theroux, because it doesn't seem like Fitzgerald was very prepared and he knew the documents very well at all. Maybe Theroux told him, by the way, this cell guy never even did drive testing. Maybe the information is going that way. Because, you know, I mean, Theroux led him to this question. He asked him this question because he wanted this answer. And it could be that Fitzgerald got the answer from Theroux himself.
That probably has to be it, because Fitzgerald is, he does do this for a living. He does know how it works. He is a cell site analysis person. So I couldn't understand how he could be saying this if he'd looked at things. And I guess it makes a lot more sense if he just took Theroux's word on it. I think it has to be that.
Yeah, I wanted to back up a second, because Rabia, you had asked about the standards for expert evidence. And actually, I just looked it up. There's a Court of Appeals in Maryland case, Blackwell versus Wyeth, and it's actually citing the Supreme Court's opinion in GE versus Joyner. And the Blackwell case is basically a case where an expert is trying to link autism to vaccines, which maybe you've heard of this huge controversy out there. And the Court of Appeals in Maryland is citing to the Supreme Court opinion in Joyner, which talks about this theory of the analytical gap, where essentially the court's saying you can't have an expert come in and simply offer assumptions or speculation, that there needs to be this direct nexus between the underlying factual predicate or data and the conclusion. And they found in that case that that analytical gap existed, and therefore the testimony was too speculative to come in. That seems exactly like what we're talking about with Fitzgerald and his friend AT&T, where they might have some expertise in cell towers and AT&T specifically, but that's not establishing the needed nexus between that knowledge and the testimony, where, Susan, from your notes, it certainly seems that analytical gap is exactly what applies. And so as much as I said before, the Payne case is huge, I think that Judge Welch and his clerks would be wise to look at the Wyeth case, because I think that's directly on point to the analysis or lack thereof done by Fitzgerald in this case.
The rest of the direct was pretty boring. It was, did you get a chance to review the cross of Wernowitz? Yes. Did you review the lines of attack? Yes. Had you heard those lines of attack before? Yes, as recently as last year. Have you heard the attacks about the testing not using the same type of phone? And Fitzgerald just said, we've heard it all at some point, I think. They'll ask if we did the drive test with the same phones as the defendant or victim. They'll ask, you know, the leaves affect it. I've heard it all. It was pretty basic. He was just saying, oh, cell phone stuff is reliable. I've never heard this crazy claim about outgoing versus incoming calls. I've never heard someone make this argument before. Or I guess Grant did, but no one other than Grant has ever made this claim while testifying. Rah, 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 rah. Then we get to the cross. Justin gets up there and just starts off saying, okay, let's talk through the sequence of events when you got engaged as a state's expert. Fitzgerald answers, the beginning of January 4th or 5th, I talked to Thiru, just a phone call. But since then, I have reviewed all the documents. He ended up getting in touch with Thiru because the cast group referred him to Thiru. Apparently, Thiru talked to someone else earlier. And 1 week after this phone call, he reviewed the documents. And then Justin points out, when Thiru wrote the expert disclosure, which is the document in which both sides declare what people they'd be calling and what the experts they'd be calling would testify to, did you ever review that? And Fitzgerald said, I didn't write it. I don't know if I ever saw it for my review. And then Justin starts drilling down on the dates. He says, so you talked to Thiru the weekend after New Year, she just said, and then a week after that, you get the documents and review them. And Justin points out, so you're saying you received the documents after the state's expert designation was filed. And then adds in, this is where he added in the kind of snarky point, you're under oath, agent. Because yes, already we're like maybe 3 minutes in, 4 minutes tops, and already Fitzgerald has contradicted himself.
It's totally a movie line right there, you're under oath, agent.
The fact it happened so soon into the testimony was amazing, because I could see after like a, you know, a long day of like back and forth, there might be something like a contradiction or something comes up. And that's kind of when you'd expect in a movie for this line to come up. But right out the gate, Fitzgerald is like backtracking and making statements and like sees a trap after already falling for it and trying to back away.
Was he kind of like belligerent with Justin, like, or was this done very pleasantly? Or I'm just trying to get like an idea of what did this sound like? How was he with Justin and how was Justin with him?
It wasn't unpleasant, because Justin just started off asking for dates about when he talked to Thiru and when he looked at the documents. And then he brought up the expert disclosure and asked him if he'd read it before it was submitted. And at some point he mentions, oh, the disclosure, the expert disclosure was filed on January 5th. And that's when Fitzgerald clued in, and he just realized he'd admitted that this expert disclosure, in which he allegedly gives his opinion about the cell phone evidence and why it's wrong and why the state's right and why the defense is wrong, that all went into the court, but like the same day he talked to Thiru and a week before he saw a single document in the case. So when he realized that, he tried to backtrack. He tried to be like, oh, actually, I'd seen some other stuff before then, and And that's when Justin came out with the, like, no, give me a firm answer. You're under oath. Don't try and weasel out when you sell the documents. And Fitzgerald takes the warning to heart, and his answer is a firm, I received the documents after January 5th. So Justin got his point through, because that's what Fitzgerald was trying to weasel out of, is admitting he hadn't read any documents when the expert designation went in.
Did Justin know this going into this, or was this something he caught?
I think he sensed something was wrong. And I'm not certain he knew for a fact. I don't think he could have, actually. I think he had a hunch and it paid off.
Good hunch.
And I like this exchange. It was like, question. So was this before or after the 5th that you got the documents? That's not what you said before. Answer. I'm sure it was after the 5th. Question. Really? Maybe I heard you wrong earlier. No, you didn't hear wrong, Justin. And then Justin points out the absurdity of this. He says, well, is it possible that the opinion given in this expert disclosure is actually Theroux's opinion? Fitzgerald says, no, it's my opinion now, too.
Now, too.
Well, oh this is crazy. He had to acknowledge he didn't have, I mean, there's no way at that point he can admit to, he didn't have an opinion. He'd never seen documents. All he'd done is talk to Theroux on the phone. And Justin asks him, so you're saying you got your opinion 100% right about this case? Everything in your analysis was 100% correct before you ever looked at a single document? And Fitzgerald said, guess so. I was close. Justin says, okay, well, close. So what'd you get wrong? And Fitzgerald eventually says, well, nothing, I guess. I guess I did get 100% right. But let's be real. Everyone knows what's going on here. Justin is correct. The expert disclosure was not the expert's actual opinion. It was Theroux's opinion, the same opinion Theroux gave in his briefs. And mysteriously, this expert he contacts the same day the expert disclosure gets filed, he happens to have an opinion that's exactly the same as Theroux's without ever saying anything.
So the prosecutor submits a document to the court saying this is going to be my expert's opinion, and there's no way the expert can have reached that conclusion. Is that like a fraud upon the court, or are the contours like kind of like unsure on this one? Or to me, that like that's a really risky thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, because he is filing this with the court before knowing that he can back it up. And one of the big things that courts look at, if you look, this is Frye is still the test in Maryland, but Daubert's the case at the federal level. And that was the case where plaintiffs claimed that the drug Bendectin caused birth defects and was based upon studies done in animals. And when that case was remanded back down from the Supreme Court, what they said is possibly the biggest factor you look at with expert opinions is independence. Is this something that the expert arrived at independently versus something that was done at the guidance of the attorney or with an eye toward litigation? And what that would point to is, in this case, this colloquy with Fitzgerald certainly makes it seem as if this came from Theroux as opposed to Fitzgerald, which that would typically be very damaging in terms of the expert analysis.
This whole only the switch is wrong, only the location one column is wrong thing, that is Theroux's argument from his briefs. That is the argument he put forward before ever talking to an expert when he was just briefing things. And when he was claiming that the subscriber activity report was not a subscriber activity report, I mean, maybe Theroux was secretly a cast member and knew this in advance. I don't know.
Justin continues on and he asks Fitzgerald, what does Abramowitz get wrong in his analysis? And Fitzgerald responds, he mentioned a call to voicemail. And Justin says, can you look that up? And he says, yes. And he says, are you going to do that on the subscriber activity report or the subscriber activity report? Which is just another level of snark that I'm amazed Justin went to, but that's brilliant. And Fitzgerald responds, I'm going to do it on the unredacted one. So he doesn't really respond to that.
He dodges the question.
Yeah. He dodges, yeah. He's like, I'm not going to take the bait. Justin also says that, you know, I actually agree with you that Abe got the voicemail one wrong. So this is interesting. I mean, Justin is saying to Fitzgerald that, you know, I actually agree with you that Abe got this wrong. And then the question is why. So there's some back and forth between him and Fitzgerald. And basically what Justin's trying to get to is that would he have gotten the voicemail issue right if he had actually had the instructions, which he didn't have, right? I mean, and that would go, again, to the heart of the matter here is how important the instructions were. It doesn't seem like he could pin Fitzgerald down on that.
Fitzgerald was a very evasive witness. He would not answer the question given. So whenever Fitzgerald started to suspect that he was, you know, being set up for something that was going to hurt the state's case, he just wouldn't answer. He would answer a different question altogether. And It did make things drag out, and they went in circles a lot. And it just because Justin couldn't get Fitzgerald to actually answer very basic questions. I am excited to see the transcript for it, because it's going to be pretty interesting to see the number of ways in which Fitzgerald can avoid giving simple answers. Justin also started to ask him about, he says, oh, so tell me about your friends at AT&T. Now, during the direct, I am pretty sure from my notes that Fitzgerald, one, said he talked to multiple people at AT&T. He used friends, plural. And he said that one of those friends was the head of subpoena compliance, or I think he actually used the word head of subpoena compliance. Now, on cross, when Justin asked him about his friends at AT&T, Fitzgerald says, oh, my friend Steve, he's a manager of subpoena compliance. We discussed the cover sheet, and here's what my notes had. Steve has been the head of subpoena compliance for how long now? Fitzgerald said 5 years, and I didn't get the details. I wish I had, because I think he later contradicts himself pretty badly here. But he does talk up Steve as if he was a manager of subpoena compliance who would have known all of this stuff. And he says that Steve went to talk to his own friends. And when Steve talked to his friends told him, we thought the exact same thing you did. Justin asked him, I assume you have some paperwork to back up your theory. And Fitzgerald just says, I believe the key on the cover sheet is talking about the expanded subscriber activity report, aka the 217 record, which isn't an answer, but I mean, the answer is no, he doesn't. And then there's a really long section where they argue over what to call documents. And Justin says, well, you realize the 222 document says subscriber activity right there, right? The answer Fitz eventually gives is, I would say it's a CDR, but it says subscriber activity. It's a subscriber activity report, not the subscriber activity report, as if that makes a difference. And then at that point, Justin tried to introduce Thiru's own brief. He wanted to put the brief Thiru wrote on the screen where it says the Exhibit 31 document is not a subscriber activity report, and point out that Thiru had informed the court falsely that it wasn't one. And Justin lost that because Thiru's own brief didn't come into evidence. Thiru fought very hard to keep it out.
Why would that have to be entered into evidence? Isn't that already part of the court's record?
I'm guessing Justin wanted to have the expert on the stand confirm that Thiru had falsely informed the court something. That was my take. Justin does get Fitzgerald to expand more on this, and eventually Fitzgerald concedes, after probably the 20th time he's asked, yes, the 222 fax is a version of a subscriber activity report. There are multiple versions of a subscriber activity report. And Justin asks him, so you think one version is somehow more of a subscriber activity report, and one version is less of a subscriber activity report because one version has more columns? And Fitzgerald just kind of says they're both CDRs. And then this was what you mentioned earlier, Colin. If Warnowitz had seen the cover sheet, he would not have made the mistake about the call to voicemail, right? And this is when Fitzgerald did, in fact, answer, well, it would have helped with one type of problem, because Warnowitz's specialty was in RF, interpreting records as far as engineering stuff goes. But his specialty is not billing docs, which is why he must have misinterpreted what it looked like when there was a call to voicemail. But Fitzgerald would not concede that the instruction sheet would have helped with anything else. Then we get to the dramatic finish on Friday, day three of the hearing. Justin asked, you've analyzed the call records in this case, right? Fitzgerald says, yes. You know them pretty well, right? Fitzgerald said, yes. And Justin says, I imagine you do. That's when he puts up some new documents and new information on the screen. And he did this very well. It worked out great because Fitzgerald isn't from DC. He's from Atlanta. He doesn't really know distances involved or what, you know, the general geographic issues are here. So Justin points out that there's one call at about 10:30 p.m. and he asked Fitzgerald to go through the process of looking at the cell site and looking at the cell site location and reading it out. And he says, oh, this 10:30 call, that came from a tower that's labeled DuPont Circle. And then Justin says, there's this next call that's 27 minutes later. Can you look that up? So Fitzgerald gets the documents, goes to the tower listing and says, that tower, it's the L651 tower in Woodlawn. Says that's in Woodlawn near Baltimore.
DuPont Circle is an area in Washington, D.C. And it's not like on the outskirts of D.C. It's like in D.C. Susan lives in the area. I live in the area. I travel between D.C. and Baltimore all of the time. Susan, how long would you say it takes without traffic? Let's say, 10:30 at night, there shouldn't be traffic, to get from DuPont to Woodlawn, driving just like the speed limit or maybe 10, 15 miles above the speed limit like a teenager might.
Having made that drive several times now, if it's an hour, you're doing good.
Because just getting out of D.C. takes like 15, 20 minutes.
Half an hour.
Yeah. And then you hit like either the parkway or like whatever connector you're going to take down to Baltimore. And that's easily another half an hour.
I mean, Thiru, when there was an issue with like showing locations and Justin asked if Thiru would stipulate that it took an hour to get from Woodlawn to DuPont Circle. And Thiru was like, yeah, I'll have to stipulate to this. Even he knew that there's no point in trying to. I mean, an hour is being generous. So, I mean, right. Thiru wasn't going to get better. So he accepted the representation. So this whole issue is difficult to try and explain through a podcast. So we'll have on the website some documents and some images explaining what's going on here. It may help to pull it up now if you're following along. And the defense team had some great graphics that were made for them by the Core Legal Concepts that illustrate exactly what problem Justin just had Fitzgerald reveal. And as you can see on the graphic, at 10:58 p.m., there's a call on L651 in Woodlawn. And at 11:25 p.m., 26 minutes, 47 seconds later, there's that call on a DuPont tower. How? How can you have a phone that makes a call on one tower and then the other when it takes an hour to go between them?
Were they both incoming calls?
The call from Woodlawn at 10:58, that was an outgoing call. But the call at 11:25, that was an incoming call.
So you have these two calls, and there's really no explanation that, you know, if you're going to make the argument that the phone had to be by the tower and that incoming calls are reliable for location, all that stuff, there's no way to explain that this guy could make a call in DuPont and then get to Woodlawn within 27 minutes. It seems fairly straightforward to me.
Yeah, I mean, I seem to recall on Twitter the various reporters there knew that the question that Justin asked about whether Adnan had a helicopter, I think that drove home the significance right there to say there's no logical way a person could drive between these locations in the time allotted that you would need a helicopter to do so. And that, I think, really communicated to the average person exactly what was going on here.
It communicated it to Fitzgerald, too, because I don't think until that second he'd realized the problem.
Was this what Jerry Grant was about to get to when Thiru cut him off?
Yep.
So, okay. And this was something Justin wanted to save until later anyways?
Yeah, Justin was, you know, that's why there was a second expert for rebuttal. And Grant was actually starting to use this as an example to explain what's going on. And I was like, oh, man, so much for this, like, be able to use it during cross would be more fun to use it. And Thiru cut him off. And so once the problem comes clear to Fitzgerald, Justin asks him, well, what's happening here? Do you know if the defendant owned a helicopter? And Fitzgerald scrambles. He says, I'd have to do more research. I'd have to look into it more. I don't know. I'd have to look more, do more research. I know DuPont is a stop on the metro. Maybe that explains it. I'd have to see how many miles apart they are. I'd have to, he listed a few more random examples and concludes, I'd need to do more research. Justin says, it's an incoming call. That's an incoming call, and it's jamming you up a bit. It's a problem. And you'd have to do research to figure it out? And Fitzgerald answers pretty straightforward this time, just yes, I cannot explain what's going on here. And Justin asked, would you agree it's impossible to be in Woodlawn one moment and then DC the next? And my notes have crickets chirping, which I think means no answer. Justin then jumps away and goes back to this whole switch issue. He says, so in the context of location and of using cell site records to determine location, no one cares what the switch is, right? In a case like this, no one would ever use the switch for location. And Fitzgerald concedes, as he did on direct too, actually, no, this is not what you use to determine location for forensic purposes. You want a cell site location for that. And I didn't get the point at the time. Actually, Abe kind of pointed it out to me later. But Justin asked Fitzgerald, so you think the switch is wrong? You think it's the switch issue that's causing this AT&T instruction about incoming calls being unreliable? So how often is the switch wrong? How often does this inaccuracy occur? And Fitzgerald answers, it's not inaccurate. It's just inaccurate for location. They're saying that you can't determine the phone was in Atlanta based on Atlanta switch listing, but I wouldn't be using that to determine location anyway. And I think what point Justin was making was that the record says incoming calls are unreliable, as in they can't be predicted. They're just not reliable sources of data. But if what was going on is what Fitzgerald says it was, that is reliable. He was describing not an inaccuracy. He's describing a predicted and known operation of the network. So for AT&T to say something's unreliable wouldn't refer to this easily describable and easily defined event. Unreliable means they don't know when the data is wrong. It was probably too subtle a point, but.
No, I get what you're saying. You're saying that unreliable means it could be accurate or it might not be accurate. Basically, we just don't know, right?
And then, but the instructions here say for any incoming call, location data is not reliable for location, right? And Fitzgerald responds, well, AT&T didn't ask me for my help in writing the cover sheet, but from what I know of putting my heads together with other AT&T people, it's what we thought it was about. And this is when the second dramatic moment, I guess, happens. And at this point, obviously, Fitzgerald was not looking happy. He looked kind of cornered. He had clearly realized he'd stepped in some shit. And there was a pause in the hearing, and then he says something like, I just found something. I want to speak to the judge. This is after like a series of questions involving some of the cell phone records. And there's a big hoopla, and Justin and the witness and Thera go up to the bench and they talk about something we can't hear. And there's a lot of like speculation in the courtroom. Like all the reporters are going, whoa, what's it about? What did he find? Did he find some answer to explain this whole helicopter problem? And I know there's a lot of like mystery over the weekend or people wondering what was going on.
Was he like looking at the documents and then suddenly he said, aha, I found something. Is that what happened?
Or yeah,
it just exactly. Occurred to him. Oh, he was looking at documents. So that's interesting. I mean, I saw this on Twitter that he wanted to speak to the judge, and that procedurally seems really odd to me. That's not how things work, right? At all.
It kind of made sense in context. So you can't have the witness discuss his testimony with an attorney midway through the cross-examination. But the judge did give limited permission for Thera to discuss this one problem with the witness.
Thera did approach him and they talked privately first?
He got permission from the judge to do it.
Okay.
Which I thought was a reasonable way to address this because the witness needed to explain this issue to someone.
But why wouldn't he just testify to it? Why wouldn't he say, oh, I just realized this is what's going on and I'm going to testify to it right now?
Because Fitzgerald thought that he had been deliberately tricked by Justin. And he thought he discovered that this attorney was fraudulently trying to fool him on the stand. And he wanted to, I don't know, bring it to the judge's attention.
I never thought that he thought that a fraud had been committed upon him by Justin because, I mean, it's Justin and I know Justin. But like that was like the furthest thing from my mind. Well, you were the one sitting in the courtroom. Did anybody know? Did you have any idea?
Yeah, I knew eventually. But at the time, I was like, there was nothing there for him to find. So I knew whatever it was going to be silly. So what we find out on Monday, when the cross resumes, it turns out that Fitzgerald had freaked out because he'd started looking at the cell phone records. And he'd realized that the defense exhibit for the 217 facts was not the same as the state's exhibit for the 217 facts. In fact, the defense exhibit is mangled. It's not presented right, and a lot of the data is missing. And the state's exhibit is the real, complete, usable copy. Fitzgerald sees this, and he is convinced that Justin is trying to somehow ruin his testimony or trick him into agreeing that cell phone records are not reliable based on this inaccurate document. So I'm not sure if Justin wants me to say this, but there wasn't actually a trick here. In court, he presents it as if, you know, he was making a point by giving these documents to Fitzgerald to demonstrate in a very direct fashion the point he was going to make about how bad Gutierrez's records were. But Fitzgerald interpreted this as a trick, so Justin rolled with it. But he was never trying to deceive Fitzgerald. That wasn't part of the plan. That wasn't like a goal he set out to do. He was going to show Fitzgerald these records and ask him questions about them and be like, well, these records that Gutierrez has, what she was doing with the cell phone records, that wasn't very useful, was it? I mean, she couldn't do what she needed to do with this, correct? But Fitzgerald saw it as a trap, so Justin said, sure, it was a trap, and you walked into it like a dumb dummy. So here's how it actually went down. At the start of cross, as it resumed again on Monday, Justin said, you were upset because, well, you were upset for a lot of reasons, but you were upset because that document referring to 217 facts was corrupt. And Fitzgerald's all fired up. Like, he comes out swinging and he says, it was manipulated evidence. There were a lot of things missing. Things were cropped off. You were trying to trick me. And Justin says, well, you'd agree with me that that's pretty much a useless document, right? And Fitzgerald says, it's useless to get the point you were trying to make. It was a very important document to show something was changed, and you were trying to sway my testimony. And Justin just lets him keep talking. He's like, right, yep, yep. And Fitzgerald just keeps on digging. And he's ranting, kind of. He's like, how dare you try and deceive me? Frankly, it's offensive that you gave me manipulated evidence. No one has ever before given me manipulated evidence. I'm offended that you handed me false evidence to adjust my testimony or to try and trick the expert. Basically, his point, which he made several times, was how dare you give me partial records and ask me to give an opinion on them?
This is amazing. But Justin was totally prepared for this, right?
Oh, yeah. He just, like, let the guy rant. It couldn't have been scripted better, because Fitzgerald believed that he had been tricked, that Justin was trying to make him give an incorrect answer by giving him only a partial set of data. So Justin let him keep believing that. Justin just rolled with it. And in doing so, he got Fitzgerald to just go off and say, like, it is offensive that you give me partial documentation of these cell phone records and ask me to give an opinion on it. How dare you, sir? How dare you? Like I said, I mean, that was not this was not a thing. Justin was just going to give him records and ask him to talk about how they were not ideal for what needed to be done here. And Fitzgerald's the one who constructed this whole trap thing. But hearing him talk, you're like, it was so perfect, because he just like goes, he is like genuinely offended that someone would dare give a cell phone expert partial documentation and ask for an opinion based on it. And he considered that being manipulative and trying to trick an expert. And like, this is the whole point. This is why we're here. We are here because Abraham Horowitz was given partial documentation of cell phone records and not told about important data that was part of the records, but not given to him. And that is why this is a problem. Fitzgerald couldn't have made that point better.
Yeah, and I've written about a similar case in my blog. This one's not out of Maryland. It's the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit, but it was a case, Sykes versus Anderson, where the defendant was suspected of stealing money and then gambling with it, and there were introduced into evidence these gaming records. And what wasn't shown to the defense was a disclaimer that said those records aren't accurate for determining the amount wagered or the identity of the gambler. And what the court found in concluding there was a Brady violation was the exhibit introduced by the state was magnified and it was cropped, so it removed timestamps and page numbers, which then failed to allow the defense to realize that this disclaimer existed and in effect disclaimed the reliability of the records. And that's, in essence, Fitzgerald, through that cross-examination, laid the foundation for exactly the same type of Brady violation, wherein he's saying these records are useless, and that's exactly the point that Justin's making. They were useless for the defense in mounting a challenge to the reliability of incoming pings.
Although it's hard to call that Brady, to be fair, because Gutierrez was so useless that, I mean, she just didn't know what she was doing with the documents. I mean, she had access to some documents, and she just didn't care about getting good copies of them, I guess. I don't know. The thing is, she should have looked at this and been like, well, this isn't right. This is worthless. State, give me the real copy. So that one's on her. I won't blame the state for this one.
And it's important to note that Justin has made this argument in the alternative. So in the end, it shouldn't matter. He said either Gutierrez was ineffective or the state violated Brady. And what that means is, whichever side of the debate you fall on, should Gutierrez have done more or not? Was she keyed off or not? It's on one side of the divide or the other. And if you think Gutierrez should have done more, it's ineffective assistance. If you think she was precluded from doing more based upon the confusing way that this was produced, then that would be Brady. And there's precedent in Maryland, specifically the Ware case, that would support either of those conclusions. So, you know, it's a matter of definitions, but in the end, either way should lead to relief.
And for the instruction sheet, just to clarify, now that I think is probably Brady. I would find Brady on these facts. But for the specific issue of the mutilated cell phone records, I think it's a fair argument to be made that she could have asked for them. But again, for the instruction sheet, she didn't know it existed and applied to these records, so she had no way to know she could ask for something. So Fitzgerald goes on for a while, more of the same. I understood what you were trying to do. I think you got caught in your game. You tried to manipulate me. And then Justin says, okay, how about you go find this document? Go find the version that I manipulated. Here's the defense binder with all the defense documents, or the ones that Theo saw fit to include. Can you find the version I manipulated in here? And Fitzgerald goes on the hunt, starts searching through it, trying to find them. And the judge loses patience, and he turns to Justin and says, help the agent find the file. And Justin says, Your Honor, it doesn't exist. Because the defense didn't have a different file. For all of Fitzgerald's bluster, he was using the same file that Theroux himself had put into the exhibits. And Justin had a great closing remark.
So Justin said, you just said that those files are so misleading, it makes you outraged. In all your years, you've never seen something so misleading. Okay, let's move on. Crazy. That's a mic drop moment.
And then Justin brings it back to the whole point. You testified before that your theory is that if the phone is off, then on, then calls are automatically tracked back to the home network. And that's the only reason for the AT&T cover sheet. Answer correct. Fitzgerald explains that he and someone else from AT&T both reviewed the data separately, and they came up with their own theory, and it matched the theory the other came up with. And Justin says, this is your buddy Steve in Florida. Again, I wish I had transcripts, but here's what Justin asked. Didn't you say your buddy was the head of subpoena compliance for AT&T? And Fitzgerald says, I don't know if I'd say head, but I'm pretty sure he did. At the very least, the way he described his buddy Steve from AT&T, he was like a manager of subpoena compliance. He was like the head of it. He was a guy who would know his stuff. But if you looked him up on LinkedIn, that's not the case. He was never a manager for subpoena compliance. He was just a legal compliance security analyst. Not the head, not the manager. Definitely not what Fitzgerald said on Friday, whether or not he used the word head. And Fitzgerald also, under questioning, admits this conversation with his buddy Steve happened on January 4th, the same day that he'd spoken to Theroux. Again, this is before Fitzgerald had seen a single document in this case. So somewhere around midway point of the second day of cross-examination, on the Monday of the hearing, there really was a noticeable change in the way Fitzgerald was acting. He kind of turned into a real expert, is the best way I can put it. He started actually answering questions. He started giving reasonable, thoughtful responses. I don't know if it suddenly occurred to him that he had read the situation wrong, or if, I don't know how to explain it, but from that point on, he actually started sounding like an expert. So one thing I did think that was interesting, and this was totally Fitzgerald bringing up on his own, despite his insisting that there's no reason incoming and outgoing calls be different, he started talking about how for an incoming call, there actually could be an issue here based on the technology, because he says there are three times that a phone registers on this network. At startup, for outbound calls, and on a timer, which it varies by carrier, but it's set up every few minutes apart. So what he said was that if a phone is initially closer to tower one, and the phone registers on that tower, and then the phone is moved closer to tower B, if an incoming call comes in, the call would still get directed through tower one. I'm using one and B, whatever, y'all can deal with it. It still gets directed through tower one, even though the phone is now closer to tower B because it hasn't registered again since the last time it did this. Which, as Fitzgerald explained in court, yes, this would cause a call to connect through a tower that was not closer to the phone and had a weaker signal than another tower because it hadn't updated to register on the closer, stronger signal. In fact, Fitzgerald also explained how the carriers often had a threshold set on this handoff. So if a phone was registered to a site, it would stay on that site until a signal with a sufficiently higher strength was detected and only then handoff. That means a handoff wouldn't happen the second a stronger signal was found. It would wait until there was a sufficiently high difference between the two signals to jump to the new tower. So as a result, the phone can stay and is intended to stay registered to a weaker signal. And when an incoming call is made, when the phone gets a page. That CDR entry is generated at the moment the call is first paged through. So Fitzgerald himself explained a reason for why you would expect incoming calls to be less reliable for location than outgoing calls. In addition to his little ranting about how it's outrageous to give a cell phone expert only partial documentation, Fitzgerald also gets not offended, but he's baffled. And I think he seemed unclear if Justin was like asking him a stupid question because it didn't make sense to him. Because Justin was saying, would it surprise you to know that Ornowitz was not provided with cell phone records or the subscriber activity reports until right before he testified? And Fitzgerald said, and I have my notes anyway, yes, it would surprise me because he did the testing. He said also, I would be shocked to hear that if he had no version of the records. I mean, how could he do the call analysis? And Justin said, right. Fitzgerald said, I find that hard to believe. I wouldn't need records to do anything pertinent. It'd be a problem. And Fitzgerald seemed to take it for granted that Ornowitz had these records before getting on the stand. No, he didn't. Ornowitz never saw the cell phone records until like the day he's getting on the stand to testify for the state. Prior to that, all he had were what Urich had told him. Like, Urich had given him towers to look up, but had not actually given him the cell site records. So he never saw any records till the day of trial, which Fitzgerald just refused to believe that was true because that was so outrageous to him. So yeah, other than that, Fitzgerald kept trying to say, I don't think Abe's opinion would change. I don't think he would have testified differently had he had this instruction sheet. I mean, of course, that's contradicted by Abe's own affidavits, but that's what Fitzgerald understood to be the case. Again, I'm just very skeptical of whether or not Fitzgerald actually looked at any records for more than a very passing glance, which is really concerning because he is an FBI expert in this stuff and testifies all the time in trials. And it bothers me a lot that an expert would do this because it was abundantly clear that he hadn't actually looked at what he was doing. He got so many basic facts wrong that he couldn't have gotten wrong if he'd looked at the stuff that I don't know. It was upsetting. And Justin even asked him at one point, like, wouldn't you say it's important for an expert to get it right? Because people trust you and rely on what you're saying. And Fitzgerald agreed, of course, but I don't know. It bothered me.
Well, I mean, I thought it was interesting that, I mean, Justin asks him, did you read and carefully review Abe's affidavit? And he says no. And then he actually has him read out two paragraphs from it, which say, if I had known it was AT&T's wireless legal policy for incoming calls to not be considered reliable information in determining cell phone location, I would have inquired further within my organization and attempted to learn why this disclaimer was issued. And if I had been made aware of this disclaimer, it would have affected my testimony. I would not have affirmed the interpretation of a phone's possible geographic location until I could ascertain the reasons and details for the disclaimer. So Fitzgerald reads this out loud. This is what Abe wrote in his affidavit, and Justin ends his cross-examination there.
And then Theo gets to try and repair his expert. He starts off trying to fix the whole, oh, my expert disclosure was submitted before my expert knew anything, snafu. And they do this by saying, oh, when I talked to you that day on January 4th or 5th, I told you that if upon further reflection there was anything you were not comfortable with in the expert disclosure, you could change it. Was there anything you were uncomfortable with? No, said Fitzgerald. And then we get back to the helicopter problem. And I was really curious to see, like, what are they going to do? How are they going to fix this? What are they going to try and say? I mean, there were better options for trying to attack this. Like, they could have tried to do something. Actually, they were kind of already screwed because Fitzgerald had been so adamant that the cell site data will never be wrong. The cell site data is never unreliable, only the switch data. He was like locked into that answer. So once the helicopter problem came up and it showed clearly a problem with the cell site data and not the switch data, I don't know how you back out of that without acknowledging that you were totally wrong when you testified on direct. But to try and fix that, Theo says, do you remember DuPont Circle and that whole issue? And Fitzgerald says, or I think actually Theo brought it up, saying like, oh, it may have been about the Metro or something, like a Metro causing issue. But to his credit, Fitzgerald is very like half-hearted about this. He says like, well, this is one thing that can cause problems with cell site data. I'm not saying it happened here. I'd have to look more into it. I have no idea if that happened here, but it's something that could possibly happen. So maybe it happened here. But he would not give a firm answer or a firm opinion that it did happen here. And he explained, so it was not just a problem in 1999. Even today, for instance, with the cell site on the subway, on this like tower listing, you might have an address that doesn't match the physical location of the tower because the address given is given for like a different part of the metro. This is because the addresses on the cell site stuff, it's not actually the address of the tower. For instance, in the records used in Anand's case, the address is the address of the property owner where the tower is located. So you can't actually use that address to directly find the tower. You have to go to that property and then hunt around for the tower. And sometimes, say AT&T has a cell site in a subway on, let's call it the Foggy Bottom stop. The Foggy Bottom stop cell site on their charts might be listed as Metro headquarters.
It's complicated to explain.
And yeah, and like also, okay, yes, this is all true, but it's also another reason that cell site stuff's not accurate because, hello, they couldn't even find a couple towers in this case. And like, we still don't know where the damn towers were because there's maps with the same tower in different locations. And this is why. So Theo then asked, is it possible that the Glenmont subway station would have the address for that cell site listed as DuPont Circle? Fitzgerald said, it's possible. I had a case like this once where we could only resolve to one location, not where in Metro the person was placing the call. And Glenmont is the closest station to Baltimore. So Theo's trying to say, oh, it says it's in DuPont Circle, but actually it was out in Glenmont, and therefore maybe he could have gotten there in 27 minutes. He couldn't have, but, you know, it's a little closer.
How does he think this makes his point? This just makes our point. It just means it's not reliable.
Yeah, I know. Like he's saying, like, oh, so this whole helicopter issue, what it actually means is that Anand left Woodlawn at 10:58 and then drove down to Glenmont to see Nisha, who lives near Glenmont. Well, no, he never saw Nisha in that time period, so that didn't happen. And the whole idea is insane and stupid. And I don't know why he thought this was a good idea. I don't know how better to put it than that, because this is crazy. First of all, so during the hearing, obviously, Abe Wernowitz couldn't hear, because he was going to be called as a witness, and he couldn't talk to him about stuff like this. So after it, I think, Robbie, you asked him, you're like, so this whole Metro thing he came up with. And he's like, AT&T did not have cell sites in the Metro at that time. They only recently got that.
Yeah, we had dinner that night, and I was like, what do you think about this argument? And he's like, yeah, AT&T had nothing there.
So, like, Theo felt comfortable proposing a factually impossible solution to the helicopter problem. Like, he didn't care about whether or not this actually could be correct. Like, he's like, oh, this can all be explained away because of this possible cell phone subway tower issue. But it's 100% factually impossible. In reality, this is never a thing that could have happened because AT&T did not have Metro cell sites. But that's all Theo did. He just tried to say, no, there's no error here. Because I guess that's all he could do, because there is an error. That error cannot be explained by what his expert was saying. In fact, that error proves his expert's wrong. So he denied there was an error.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. There literally was no other way to rehabilitate this. So there's nowhere for him to go. There's no way to explain, you know, how somebody could travel that quickly. Basically, this is exactly why that fax cover sheet instruction existed.
And it's not the only time. It's the clearest example, the most dramatic one for court purposes, but it's not the only time where there's big problems with this incoming call issue. And it does seem like AT&T does switch the cell site. And I've heard a few reasons, like just speculations, we don't know, but like there are reasons why the database would have only recorded one cell site. And if two people in an AT&T network are calling each other, you don't know if it's recording the caller's cell site or if it's recording the person being called cell site, which is the very definition of unreliability. So what happened was, like, Abe Wernowitz got in a plane and flew in from the West Coast to testify. And at that point, the PCR hearing, kind of like our PCR recap episodes, had extended much longer than was expected. And they were already on day 5 of the hearing. And the judge had told them, like, let's move it along, people. This is taking longer than it needs to. So given that the only real or the biggest point that Wernowitz needed to testify to was that, no, Fitzgerald was not correct when he said that my opinion would have changed, they put it in an affidavit instead. And here's what it said. I had not seen the legend when I was asked to testify in the trial of Anand Syed. In fact, I was shown what was then State's Exhibit 31 only while I was in the courthouse waiting to testify. Had I seen the fax cover sheet and legend, I would not have testified that State's Exhibit 31 was accurate. And that says it all. I mean, despite what Fitzgerald testified to about what he thought would have happened, it was very clear, like, if I'd known of this issue, I was not going to affirm the reliability of data that I have no reason to believe is reliable, and there's clearly errors with it. Oh, and one other thing I found interesting was in his affidavit, I guess Justin asked him to talk about the whole, does the cover sheet apply to the 217 documents or the 222 documents? And Abe wrote, after reviewing all these documents, I find the fax cover sheet legend ambiguous, specifically the definition of location and which incoming calls are reliable. However, I interpret this legend to most likely apply to both the 222 and the 217 records, and I interpret location status to most likely apply to cell tower locations, which can be used to estimate a cell phone's location, which I thought was just a perfect example of what an expert should be saying compared to what Fitzgerald was saying on the stand. Because Fitzgerald was saying, oh, I logically reasoned it out and here's an answer for sure and I know for a fact this is it. And as Abe pointed out in his affidavit, no, it is ambiguous. There is ambiguity here. The record, it doesn't specifically define location, so Abe wasn't going to make a firm opinions on something he actually can't have knowledge of. And he does think that the legend most likely applies to location for all of the records and applies to estimating a phone's location, but he acknowledges there are other ways to read it. And I wish Fitzgerald had taken a similar approach, and he probably wishes he had too.
In his interview with The Intercept, prosecutor Kevin Urich underscored the importance of the cell tower evidence. According to Urich, Jay's testimony in and of itself was problematic and questionable. It was only through corroboration by the cell tower pings, and especially the incoming Lincoln Park pings, that the jury was able to move from doubt to beyond a reasonable doubt. But should the jury ever refer that evidence? And even if they did, could Gutierrez have challenged its reliability based upon the AT&T disclaimer? Now, the Court of Appeals of Maryland has noted that when expert testimony is being offered, the court should only receive it if the judge is able to find that the proponent's experts are more knowledgeable than the opponent's experts. Now, in this case, we've gone through and discussed the testimony of Chad Fitzgerald for the state, the testimony of Gerald Grant for the defense, and the affidavit submitted by Abe Warnowitz. In the end, this is exactly what Judge Welch is going to do. He's going to look at, as we just did today, what was said by Fitzgerald, what was said by Grant, and what was said by Warnowitz. And unless the judge finds that Fitzgerald is more knowledgeable than Warnowitz and Grant, there's a very good likelihood Adnan will be granted a new trial.
Many thanks to Ramiro Marquez for our theme music and photography, to Christy Williams for our website, and to Baluki, who designed our logo. Our production consultant is Rebecca Lavoie. She's a true crime author and hosts the podcast Crime Writers on Serial. Dennis Robinson is our producer. And you can find us online on social media on both Facebook and Twitter. Our Twitter handle is UndisclosedPod. Make sure to tweet us your comments and questions using the hashtag Undisclosed.
The Undisclosed Podcast is brought to you in part by the Adnan Syed Trust, a legal defense fund that helps to pay Adnan's legal fees and associated investigative efforts. All proceeds raised through advertising on today's episode of Undisclosed were given to the trust. To learn more about the trust and to donate to our efforts to free Adnan, please visit www.launchgood.com/freeAdnan.